And right now, our new technology commentator today is Steve McCabe. A very good morning to you, Steve.
Good morning, Catherine.
Virtual format wars.
Yes. What's going on at the moment is an interesting little development that's come out recently, basically based around the fact that, historically, every time we've bought new videos, new DVDs, new Blu-ray videos, what we're finding is that we buy a new format. And next thing you know, there's a new format that's come out that supposedly has higher quality, better resolution, better features. And we think, well, there's a film I love. I want to be able to watch it again. I'm going to have to go and spend a lot of money and buy it in a new format. And then possibly I buy a new mobile device. I want to be able to put that same film on that new mobile device. And it's been either very expensive to keep buying new physical formats, or there's been all manner of legal implications with regard to legality of licensing, of copying what you've got in a physical format onto, say, your iPad or your laptop. And it's been a problem for a lot of people. Some people got conscience issues. Some people got financial issues with it. And so what we're now seeing is a new development from a large consortium in the U.S. Other companies have developed a system that they're calling Ultraviolet, which supposedly is going to be a way of getting around this problem. The idea is going to be you buy a copy of a film and it's going to come with a license code. And that says that rather than having just bought that disc and that's it, you're done with it, you've now actually bought a license to watch that film in pretty much whatever format happens to come out in the future, which is supposedly going to mean that if you buy the film on DVD, you can then eventually download a copy of it to stick on your laptop and take it, say, on a flight with you. And that will be totally legal, totally legitimate, and it will be done with the blessing and, in fact, with the cooperation of the company that you bought the movie from in the first place.
How do they make their money?
Well, that's always going to be the question, isn't it? The bottom line always has to be where the revenue is coming from. And it used to be that if you spend your $20 on your VHS cassette, a few years later you'll then spend another, say, $30 on a DVD, and then you'll spend, I don't know how many more dollars on a Blu-ray disc, and you can see how the progression is going to go there, can't you? That's supposed to be the idea. What they're doing with this now is they're saying, well, you pay once and you get repeatedly. What they're actually making the money with, it would appear, is they are locking you into only being able to get hold of it on their format, on their source. And what they're trying to do, really, is that they're claiming that this is going to help the customer. What it's actually doing is it's locking into a certain source, and supposedly it's actually going to reduce piracy, and that seems to be the big thing that's driving it for these companies, is that they are going to see people buying these files legally, but then they're going to be locked into, when they download them, files that have DRM, digital rights management features built into them. The idea basically is, I download a film legally from these people, it's got my unique identifier on it. If I try to hand that file to you, you won't be able to play it because your computer isn't authorized to play that file. That, it's intended, is going to be the benefit to the copyright holders. It's going to reduce the passing around, the sharing, if you like, of copyrighted material.
Yeah, but at the moment, don't they get the benefit of the fact that the technology, or is this more the people who make the technology? The technology keeps changing and the format in which you had it becomes outdated.
Well, that's the model at the moment. But what they're discovering is that increasingly people are sort of shunning the technology
altogether.
Increasingly, people are more interested in the digital file itself. They don't really care what physical format it ships in, so long as they can get the bits and bytes. And as long as that's being put out in a way that's stripped of any kind of rights management, then it's of no benefit to the copyright holder. What they're trying to do, as far as we can tell, is come up with a system that effectively prevents you from sharing it.
Yeah, I understand that, but my point is, part of the way they made their money was surely that we went from we went from videotape to DVD, and then the different kind of discs came in, and so what you had in your library began to become obsolete, and you
Absolutely.
Were perhaps rebuying. So this is kind of a deal for both sides, one presumes.
Well, it's being portrayed as a deal for both sides, yes. The idea is that when a new format comes out, you will not have to keep repurchasing it. It's kind of a bit vague and uncertain with regard to physical format. So, for example, when we went from DVD to Blu-ray, that's a new physical format, which involves an actual thing in a box that has to be produced physically and shipped. It's not entirely clear that you're actually going to be able to be issued with a new physical format when it comes out. And that's going to be where the money is still going to be made, assuming that you still have to actually buy whatever the successor to Blu-ray might be in a few years' time. Presumably, we'll still have to buy the physical kit. What we won't have to buy is a new license for the content. That seems to be where the saving might be for the purchaser.
All right. And so, ostensibly, the consumer wins.
Ostensibly, the consumer wins, but only as long as that consumer is willing to cooperate very rigidly within the context of the ultraviolet scheme. It means that you can only legally, and they're working on the assumption here that you are not going to do anything that contravenes their copyright terms and licenses. They're assuming that you are only going to use these file formats within their constraints. It suddenly means that you can only do it within contexts that they authorize. So, for example, one glaring omission to all of this is the Apple infrastructure. Apple want no part of this. Apple want to keep their iTunes system completely under their own control, so they're not getting part of this. And where Apple go in this context, Disney will follow, due to Steve Jobs having been the single major shareholder in Disney. And so as long as you've got that very, very major player in this context not being part of it, then suddenly you're going to have either being able to play your Apple-connected content on your Apple devices, or it would appear your Ultraviolet Consortium-related content on a format and within a system that has been deemed suitable within the Ultraviolet system. So, for example, you're going to have different software on your computers. You might not be able to play this necessarily through iTunes on your iPad or iPhone. It's going to be basically a splitting of formats, unfortunately. And historically, we've always seen that when formats get split, ultimately one ends up going by the wayside. It's happened with videotapes. VHS was successful, and Betamax went by the way. With high-definition DVDs, Blu-ray won the day, and HD DVD is now a thing of the past. And unfortunately, what generally tends to happen is it's not technological merit that will make that decision. It's going to be market forces, and it's going to be whichever format has the more powerful backers is going to be the one that wins.
So is it all a done deal, pretty much?
Well, pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's happening. It's starting. You know, there's a long list. There's about 30-odd companies who signed up to this consortium. As I said, with Disney and Apple holding out on this yet, it might just not quite get the critical mass it's going to need to become completely entrenched. But increasingly, companies ranging from Warner Brothers to Netflix in the US, who are basically the American model that Fatso in New Zealand was based upon, those are on board. A lot of major labels are taking part. There's a lot of distributors are taking part. Certainly in the US, it's looking like, in all likelihood, this will be the future of the way that these things are distributed, yes.
Now, the social media sort of tip of the week is what?
Yeah, it seems like that's all we ever talk about on this show these days. Social media popping up and dying everywhere you look.
So one's come and gone since last time?
Well, the one that's come since last time, it's been slowly and quietly hyped for quite a while. It's one that I believe we're pronouncing diaspora, even though they spell it with a little asterisk at the end of the name. I think that's silent. But we're saying, yeah, the diaspora has launched, and most people's reaction is going to be, super, another social network, because we've got more than we know what to do with already, with Google Plus trying very, very hard to become relevant. But yeah, diaspora has just been launched, and the big deal with it is that if we want to use, say, a computer analogy here, it's kind of like the Linux of the social media networking world. It's completely open source. It's completely distributed, hence the name Diaspora. There's no one central server or monolith like there is, say, with Facebook. Basically, Diaspora is a series of computers distributed around the world, all of which are running a social network. And the idea is that you are not, basically, as is the case with Facebook, you are not basically becoming a product, or your information, I should say, isn't a product that's then being sold on to advertisers. It's being run for and by its users is the ethos behind it.
For and by its users, well, how does that make it different from all the others, really?
Well, as I say, with Facebook, for example, the big deal behind Facebook is it's being run for profit. The Facebook corporation want you to sign up and want you to put as much data personal data, ideally, into their system as possible, so that then they can start selling advertising space. They're basically renting out your eyeballs on your behalf. That's what Facebook exists for. The idea, at least, and we're obviously getting a little bit philosophical here, but the idea supposedly behind Diaspora, with the asterisk at the end, is that it's being run on a non-profit basis. It's being run with open source software that anyone can use, anyone can set up their own Diaspora server and can expand the network, and nobody is making profit from
it. So all those privacy issues that have come up and have become controversial in recent times, would all of them be averted by this?
Well, that's the idea at the very least. The idea is that one thing they're doing, first of all, is that they're actually allowing pseudonyms, which has been a very big issue on both Google Plus and Facebook, who said, no, you may not use pseudonyms. You must use real names. You must be fairly transparent, which for whatever reason, people have reasons for not wanting to use their real names. People are entitled to use whatever name they want, except on, say, Facebook, who say, no, you're going to have to be who you are. It's been very difficult, for example, to sign off from Facebook or to actually see what data they're storing about you. The idea, at the moment, we're going to have to take Diaspora at the word at the moment because no one's really had a chance to fully explore this, but the idea that they're saying is, any data you put there, you can see what we know about you. Whatever you reveal about yourself is available to you. You can take it down whenever you like. It won't be stored without your knowledge and consent. And unlike the Facebook model, which says you can check out but you can never leave, they're not doing that. If you check out, you leave.
There you go. The question is, will it take off? Because for all that, big names are often berated and hated and everything else, they're where everyone flocks. That's where everyone is.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is always going to be the issue, and it's always going to be the standard question that's going to have to be asked every time I come on your show and talk about another social network, because they're keeping popping up, and they're keeping on trying to do the same thing, which is trying to supplement or supplant Facebook. And it's not going to happen because that's a system that has gained so much traction. Everybody's using it. As I've said in the past, there's a reason why the film was called The Social Network, not just A Social Network. That's the default. And until somebody comes up with something fantastically compelling, and I think that's going to have to be, that translates into something different, then I don't know that anyone's really at this point going to be able to knock Facebook off its pedestal.
The Falklands War goes digital. What is involved with this project?
Oh, this is not a project, actually. This is more a campaign, to be honest. This is where technology meets politics. And as we've established in the past, every internet address ends in a country code, what we call a CCTLD, a country code top level domain. Like New Zealand internet addresses all end in .nz, for example. And every territory, not just every country, but every territory, is assigned one of these two-letter CCTLDs. And the Falklands, for years, have been using .fk. Now, I've tried finding out how many domains are actually registered within that space. I've not been able to get that information, but I can't imagine it's terribly many. But the reality is that's an entity, that's a property that belongs to the Falklands government, and it's been functioning that way perfectly well for a very long time. The problem is that the Argentinian government has suddenly noticed that a territory which they claim to be part of their national territory is acting like it's independent. And so what they suddenly said is that they're appealing to ICANN, the Internet Council for Assigned Names and Numbers, to have the .fk domain space cancelled. They're saying that it shouldn't exist because the Falklands are not an independent territory. The Islas Malvinas are part of the national territory of Argentina. And what they're saying is that they should be granted control of the .fk domain. It should then be allowed to go away. And in future, all Falklands internetness should now become part of the .ar domain space.
Is that the way it works necessarily? And will they be successful?
Well, in theory, that is the way it works. If a governing, a government of a territory decides that that territory no longer should have its own separate domain space, then fair enough, they're entitled to it. That's the issue. The Argentinian government is saying that they should be the governing body of the Falklands. The Falklands say, no, you're not, and we are not willing to relinquish that .fk domain space. And ICANN's rules say that unless the existing owners of that space voluntarily relinquish control of the CCTLD, then it goes nowhere. So as long as Port Stanley are saying, Nah, we don't think so. Then it's not going to go away. But it's just interesting to see that the diplomatic posturing has now spilled over into cyberspace.
Speaking of diplomatic posturing, or perhaps political posturing, the new anti-piracy laws that we have covered extensively on the program, are we seeing some of the first warning notices being sent out, are we?
It's just happened this week, actually, yes. The very first batch. And it's interesting to see how it's all coming out. In theory, any copyrighted material is subject to protection under this Act. So far, we've not seen anything from the film studios. But what we have seen this week is the Recording Industry Association of New Zealand has sent out a number of notices to Telecom, to Orcon, and to Telstraclear. You know, it's through the major internet service providers, saying your customers are illegally downloading our content. Apparently, it's stuff from Lady Gaga and Rihanna is the material that's coming to their attention.
It's a new form of notoriety, isn't it? Being the most or the regarded as the most significant, almost rampant downloading that's going on illegally?
Exactly. I mean, the other way of looking at it is you could make the case the Rolling Stones I'll pay for, but Lady Gaga I only steal. I mean, you could take it that way. But at the very least, apparently, so say Telecom, for example, had 42 notices. 35 of them were allegedly for downloads of songs by Rihanna. Six of Lady Gaga, apparently. So, yeah, I mean, these are at the forefront of everything, including copyright violation warnings. Now, this is obviously a major, major concern. And the issue is, I mean, let's be honest, chances are, in most households, it's not going to be the person whose name is on the bill for the internet connection.
Well, that's another interesting thing. When you're wondering who they're targeting, whether they're targeting a certain demographic with a view to waking parents up to what kids are downloading.
Well, that's quite possible. It's also likely, to be fair, that the parents are likely to be the ones who have more money and are actually willing to buy the content, whereas kids are likely to say, oh, I'm going to steal that one, or I'm going to download it for free. I think that's probably what's going on there. But yeah, as you say, they do appear to be particularly targeting very, very specific markets, and it could be that they want to scare people a little bit.
Thanks very much, Steve. Steve McCabe, new technology commentator.